next talk is by Stephen LeConte, and it's entitled Classification of fMRI-based Cognitive States.
Great, thank you very much. I'd like to start by thanking everybody who helped with organizing this fantastic program. I wish I could have been here for the whole 2 weeks, but I'm really delighted and honored to be here today. Organization might be a strong word, we'll see how it goes, but what I'd like to do with this talk is start with some background and motivation that I think really overlaps nicely with what Francisco's message was for today. And in fact, a lot of this talk, I think, will be a nice overlap and not orthogonal, but not completely overlapping view of some of his points. So I'd like to talk about some basic principles, primarily focusing on classification of fMRI data, but machine learning in general, and then move on to talk about how evaluation and interpretation can be done on these sorts of predictive models, both generally and then also with some specific considerations that come from the domain that we're interested in, which is fMRI. And then I'd like to also talk more specifically about work in my lab that's using this sort of supervised learning framework to do real-time fMRI. And then I'll end with some tools and resources pointing to the MVPA software and also giving a brief example of a toolbox that I've incorporated into AFNI. So although univariate approaches have dominated fMRI analysis, it has been long and widely recognized that supervised and unsupervised multivariate approaches fundamentally complement the information that can be obtained from univariate methods. For fMRI, one of the early demonstrations of this sort of brain state decoding came from this study in which regions of interest were obtained for left and right motor tasks, and then in an independent data set, these ROIs were tracked and used to predict whether left or right motor responses were obtained. More formal classification analyses and methodological development have come from a number of groups, including collaborations with Steve Strother and Lars Hansen, who have spoken here this week, Tom Mitchell's group with Francisco being part of it, Janaya, and multiple other groups. So one of the things that I'll be talking about is work that I did with Steve Strother using predictive modeling as a means of assessing methodological choices, specifically competing methodological choices of pre-processing. In terms of impact to cognitive science, as was mentioned before, I think, and as they codified in this figure by Haxby's 2001 paper, this sort of analysis has gained a lot of attention in its potential for helping us to understand how the brain represents different classes of stimuli. And again, with some nice overlap, I must have had a good prior on the previous talk, some very innovative and exciting work has come from this. And so this is an example, again, of a neural network that's able to trace memory recall in terms of faces, or in terms of people, places, and objects. And again, as I mentioned in the outline, I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about how this sort of classification and predictive supervised modeling in general actually turns out to be a very natural means of doing real-time fMRI, in which the decoded states of the brain, if you will, could be used to adaptively control the stimulus and form a closed experimental system. And then innovations continue to arise. And so this is a very interesting study that was mentioned in which system identification out of a very large number of images was able to perform with a high degree of accuracy. And I think also is going to be talked about today, having an impact on this field has been the fact that there's been data analysis competition sponsored by Pittsburgh and as part of the Human Brain Mapping Conference for the previous 2 years. So I'll be interested to hear that talk this afternoon. So in terms of basic principles, as was mentioned in the first talk, supervised learning starts with a first step of obtaining a relationship between the image data or your features and the labels. And so in this training step, what we're trying to do is estimate the parameters for a supervised learning model. And then once we have that model, we can apply these features or these images to the model to try to use that to decode what the stimulus or behavioral conditions were at the time the images were collected. And so for the classification case, why is some way of coding the stimulus or behavioral categories? And in this case, you would have discrete categories, say from 0 to n. Most algorithms are designed to handle vector data. And so in fMRI, we have some sort of spatial and temporal relationship where the features, as was mentioned quite nicely before, can be the actual voxels or some transformation of the voxels. And then we have some temporal information about the stimulus or behavioral categories and temporal observations of these images. And so just to give kind of a high-level view, I'm going to use the normal excuse that I can only look at two dimensions easily on a plane here. So if we were to look at two voxel intensities in a single time point, we could transform this image into a vector and then represent it in this two-dimensional space. So this would be the axis for, say, voxel 1, and this would be for voxel 2. So in this case, voxel 2 would be slightly brighter. So this is our two-voxel brain, which I've been accused of. This is actually my two-voxel brain, but it's not. But if I did have a high-functioning two-voxel brain, we could do an fMRI experiment with it. Say we had category A of stimuli and category B, then we might obtain some arbitrary distribution over the time of this experiment from which we could obtain some discriminant boundary. And so then, of course, future data, if it were to fall in this part of the plane, we would classify it as belonging to category A. The same can be, or a very similar concept can be done in terms of regression. So if we have a parametric experiment where we have different levels of the same category, say, we may get different voxel intensities, putting data points at different planes for labels that actually vary in some fashion. And so then, given an appropriate loss function, we can then design a regression curve such that, for example, if this were a rate of finger tapping, say, we could say that images up here would correspond to a high rate of finger tapping. So the basic idea for classification and regression is that we want to take this high-dimensional input space in general, which is our images or other features derived from these voxels, and reduce it to a scalar, a very low-dimensional object that relates to what was going on in the experiment. And depending on what's in that black box, various things can be more or less natural. So for example, linear boundaries may be more natural for some approaches, whereas nonlinear boundaries may be easier to obtain depending on the type of model that you're using. Similarly, for example, support vector machine is generally regarded as a two-class model, but there are various ways of generalizing that to a multi-class case. So here, for example, is shown a toy data set where we do every possible two-class model, and by combining these with something like a directed acyclic graph, you can come up with the partitioning in this space for multiple classes. And there are lots of other ways to do this. So in terms of what's in this black box, I'm going to use as case studies linear discriminants analysis and support vector machines to try to give an idea of what can be obtained from these classifiers. So encoded in here is some estimate. These polygons actually kind of give you some idea about dimensionality. So if we were to input our image data, it's fairly high dimensional. We actually need, in the case of linear discriminant analysis, to reduce that dimensionality such that our feature space is smaller. And from there, we can obtain some linear weights that allow us to do this decoding or prediction. So what we do is we start with our data matrix, time by voxels. And again, voxels tends to be the biggest dimension. So when we do a PCA or an SVD of this matrix, we know that its rank is at most the number of time samples that we've acquired. And so the dimension of this Q matrix is going to be at most time by time. So time actually hasn't changed. So our labels in terms of what the behavioral or stimulus conditions were at the time these were taken are still the same. But our rows are now different. Our voxels are now some combination of these original voxels. If you notice, this looks very similar to what I'm sure you heard earlier this week with, for example, the ICA talks. So in a sense, this becomes a mixing matrix that gives us a new set of features that are a combination of the original input features. Because we have the original time information, we can look at the covariance structure of this matrix. And what's of interest in the case of linear discriminants analysis is the covariance within classes and the covariance between classes. And so what you'd like to do is find directions within this space that when you project onto those directions, you have the appearance of a smaller within-class variance and larger between-class variance. So you want the distributions to look compact, but also far away from each other. And so by taking, doing an eigen decomposition of this between over within matrix, you are able to obtain those directions. Now, the support vector machine has a very different formulation. And so we start with our original feature space, and in the general case, we can actually use a nonlinear kernel function that could even put us into a higher dimensional space in some cases. This feature space, then, we find a linear decision boundary, as was mentioned before. But because we potentially used a nonlinear mapping function, this linear discriminant boundary actually translates into a nonlinear boundary in the original input space. So we're going to go back to these equations a couple of times, but I'd just like to mention that this weight vector relates to your discriminant boundary, and how you obtain it is described by this equation, in which you want to minimize this entire term. This, we'll talk about in a couple of slides, allows for some training errors, and this favors the widest possible margin. And so this leads us into the topic of model selection. So in general, model parameters are fit based on the training data, but as has been mentioned, the data that we're collecting comes from a finite amount of data, and it also comes from noisy samples. And so the classical approach looks at the bias variance trade-off with selecting these models. So as was mentioned quite nicely, if the model is too flexible, we have a tendency to be overfitting to the noise. And if the model is not flexible enough, it won't be adaptive to the signal structure. And so in that case as well, our performance will be hampered. In statistical learning theory, the idea is to keep the empirical risk constant. So in other words, what you can see is the training data, and you want to control for that, and you want to minimize the confidence interval over that. However, in practice, maybe some of this is a little bit moot, because what is done is that we need to either penalize our model complexity with some analytic function, or use resampling, such as cross-validation or bootstrap. So traditionally, again, model complexity is done with model-based number of model parameters, whereas in the support vector machine, we want to control the size of the margin. So, and in both cases, what we'd like is to optimize prediction accuracy. So back to these equations again. This term here favors the widest possible margin as we're minimizing it, whereas this term allows us to have some errors and C then is a parameter that allows us to control that. So the margin, I've done a lot of talking about the margin without describing what it is. In the separable case, when we when we have a very large C, for example, infinite, the margin is defined by the minimum distance between the separating hyperplane and your data point. So then these points define the support vectors because they determine the direction of the separating hyperplane. When you allow for errors, you actually can have examples on the wrong side of the hyperplane. And so relating this to this weight vector, we would see that in this case, voxel 2 is having most of the impact in terms of this classification model. So, so if we were to look at that weight vector and threshold it, we would see that voxel 2 is surviving the threshold and perhaps voxel 1 wouldn't. In the case of non-separable data, you need to use a C factor. And again, this is illustrated that when you have a very small C, you can have a wider margin, whereas if C is large, you tend to have a smaller margin. And so this then will impact how accurate your models are. So in order to evaluate how well the model is doing, we need to think about prediction accuracy on independent data, and this has been stressed well before. So in general, independence, we're strictly talking about being able to factor probability densities. But in practice, what we do is try to use common sense. So there's autocorrelation within a run, as has been mentioned, but as you go across runs, across sessions, and across individuals, you have a stronger argument that your data are independent. And really the crux of this is that if you have some correlations or higher order dependencies between your training and your test data, you tend to inflate your estimate of prediction accuracy. So just as is the case for predicting voxels that are on or off, we need to consider the case of being able to have good or bad or positive or negative predictions. So if, for example, we're working with faces versus scramble faces, we could designate faces as the positive case and scramble faces as the negative case and look at the rates of all possible outcomes of your classifier. And some useful quantities can be derived from those weights. So one of which is accuracy, sensitivity, and specificity. These three are fairly common. So accuracy, for example, is the number of predicted positives and negatives over all of the data, whereas sensitivity is the number of predicted positives over all positives, and specificity is the number of negatives over all true negatives. However, for the case of fMRI, we're also interested in the spatial patterns that can be obtained from these data. And so in addition to just prediction accuracy, we've also worked with Steve Strother, who's looked at the global reproducibility of these patterns. So this actually culminated into a very general data analysis framework termed N-pairs. And part of that we've worked with is reproducibility and prediction accuracy. And you know, what I want to talk about is the ability to use this framework to quantify the quality and validity of neuroimaging results with these model performance metrics of reproducibility and prediction accuracy. So what we've done is we've actually split the data into two halves. Again, this isn't optimal for just strictly a prediction accuracy question, but it does lend to a trade-off between looking at these global reproducibility patterns. So with this split, this figure looks more complicated than it is. You can designate half of the data as training and come up with a model, but also applying it to this test split, have a prediction accuracy estimate. And so you see that at the end, we get two models that we can look at as statistical parametric maps and look at their reproducibility. And also we get two measures of prediction accuracy. So we actually applied that that block diagram 800 times to obtain these following these curves. And what we did was we actually controlled model complexity by using principal components analysis. And these curves represent prediction accuracy and mean reproducibility. So as we go along these curves through bigger symbols, we actually have more complicated models. And the symbols themselves represent the pre-processing choices that were applied. So for example, circles represent highly smooth data and triangles represent no smoothing, whereas the colors look at alignment versus no alignment. And what we see is we actually get a large impact on this. Comparing those results in a different format to support vector machine, we actually get less sensitivity in this case in terms of prediction accuracy. And so what we've seen is that pre-processing choices are critical for optimizing fMRI data analysis. We've demonstrated a data-driven method called mPairs for appraising competing methodological choices. In this particular data set, the SVM was more robust or less sensitive to pre-processing than CVA. But I guess one point that I left off of this slide is that in some cases, CVA may actually, since it is sensitive, lead us to more understanding of what's going on in terms of the signal and noise properties of this data. In terms of interpretation, I wanted to start with a quote. The predictive learning setting does not guarantee that accurate predictive models closely approximate the true model. And this is a consequence of the fact that we're dealing with finite, noisy data. So interpretation can be difficult, especially if we're looking at nonlinear models. And since we're using generally multivariate methods, we can obtain information about both spatial and temporal properties. And I think, as was emphasized quite well in the last talk, it's very important to get to know your data, but also important to know the analysis methods that you're applying. So the following is kind of a case study of the type of information that can be obtained through support vector machines. As we see again, these polynomials kind of iconify the support vector machine, and this decision boundary comes from this weighting in the feature space. But an equivalent form of this equation shows that actually the support vectors are sensitive to this so-called alpha, which essentially describes the weighting of each observation into the model. So the optimal weight vector is a linear combination of only a subset of the training vectors, and these are termed the support vectors. So the SVM model consists of a predefined kernel function, the support vectors, and the support vector class labels. So each point in this feature space corresponds to a spatial pattern. Again, if these were individual images, each of these would be a single time point. And so only part of these images are being used as support vectors. So conceptually, the support vectors are observations that are most difficult to classify. Conversely, observations that are far away from the separating hyperplane are most easily classified. And in fact, they don't even fall into this weighted equation. And so if we were to remove them, the model actually wouldn't change, which is not the case for, say, linear discriminant analysis, where the entire distribution is used to estimate the covariance. And so by removing these points that are far away from this hyperplane, you could have dramatic effects on your model. So again, the weights or the support vectors actually have temporal information encoded in them. So some of these observations, the black, don't fall into the model at all. And other time points are used to various degrees, so that can be looked at. So the weights can have direct spatial meaning that can be overlaid on the anatomy. And but if we're using a nonlinear kernel, then it's not possible to directly overlay this map. And so one way to do this would be to use sensitivity maps, as proposed by Jims et al. In 2002. This has the benefit of being general enough to be applied to nonlinear methods and allows for direct comparison across methods. However, it's computationally very expensive, and actually the sensitivity maps can sometimes be a misnomer because the sensitivity actually depends on the accuracy of this distribution estimation and also the partial derivative that you can apply to this density estimation. But just to kind of show that this works in theory, this is just a very quick simulation that I did using some work that put the support vector machine into a Bayesian framework so that we could get this density estimation function. And then simulating data like this and applying this equation, you can get back this actual map. So there's a lot to consider in terms of fMRI. First of all, dimensionality often can be a very big problem. A hemodynamic response lends to sluggishness in terms of when the stimulus or behavioral condition occurred versus when changes are actually detectable through fMRI. And this is very much related to the timing that's used in your experiment, whether or not it's block design, event-related, or some other complex stimuli, such as in the competition data. So I know that the next talk talks about feature selection, but I wanted to mention that feature selection itself could be used to obtain spatial maps in terms of what areas are important. And so this is just an example of that for data collected on rapid event-related data of left and right motor tapping versus index versus pinky tapping. So in terms of looking at the hemodynamic response, there are a number of things that are reasonable. Probably the most reasonable thing is to model the HRF. However, another thing that can be done is to actually just temporally shift your labels to compensate for the fact that you know you have a known delay in the hemodynamic response. However, if you're just interested in the steady state portion of activation, another thing that's quite reasonable and we and other groups have done is to simply drop the transition scans. And in terms of what the ramifications of this are, they haven't been well studied. And so this is an attempt to do that. Now, I need to back up from these figures to be able to explain them. What actually happened was I have some training data, say left finger tapping versus right finger tapping, let's say, or faces versus houses. And each of these plots below correspond to training a model with all of the data, just taking the labels as they are, or incrementally excluding from our training data set the first transition scan into that category of images, the first two or the first three. And then assuming that the hemodynamic response is preserved, in this case this was a left versus right button press task, and so we assume that the hemodynamic response across hemispheres would be fairly similar. What you can actually do is collapse this test data in terms of reporting purposes into these bins and look at the distribution of errors with respect to this block of activity. And so that's what this plot shows. And so one very dramatic thing that happens is when you train with all the images versus excluding these transition images, you see in the steady state part of the block a very dramatic decrease in misclassifications. So, for example, in this particular data set, there were 102 possible chances to make an error within each of these time bins. However, by the time we got to the exclude three models, we were getting down to 2, 1, even 0 errors across each of those 92 possible observations in this part of the block. However, another thing that maybe isn't as dramatic, but is quite important, is that actually you get an increase in errors at the early part of the block when you do this sort of thing. And so what's going on is the model is actually trying to incorporate the information from the entire part of the block, both the transition part and the steady state part. And so looking at this in a different way, we can look at the steady state part and the transition and all of the data. If we were just to look at the classification error for all data, we would see that excluding two is about optimal in terms of overall error. Whereas if we just look at the steady state part, arguably excluding two is also fairly optimal, but we get much higher accuracies again in the steady state part. And this actually has quite an impact, and as I'll be talking about real-time systems, this could be a very important sort of observation. Because actually what we see is that the model trained without transition images actually tends to be more stable in these steady state parts, which bears out in the previous images. So this is using training with all images versus excluding two, and you see that you're farther away or making stronger predictions about these. And they're, these all image predictions are somewhat closer to being misclassified, although, not dramatic. However, if you don't look at the average data, this is even more visible. And the other thing to note, though, is that the predictions that are made with the model that includes all the images are actually less sluggish than those with the excluded two. And so what you see is, even on a 2-second TR basis, where you have button presses, and because you have an instantaneous switch between left and right, say, you'll get actually a reaction time delay where this is actually a corrupted image, where there's a little bit of left and a lot of right button presses. But in this classifier that was used with all the data, you see that it's trying to get up to the right answer, whereas this is delayed by several images. So I think that these are something to look at in closer detail. And it's actually possible to change the labels of your data. So this is the exact same data, but what I've done is I've actually labeled the first two images as transition images and all of the rest in the block as steady state images. So now my labels have changed. And what you see is spiking at about the right times. And if you do a time-locked average of that, you see that what you're getting is a difference between these transition versus non-transition data. And as was mentioned earlier, I have kind of a non-balanced case here because I only have two observations in each block of transition, and I forget how many, 15 or so. These are in seconds, so the TR was 2 seconds. But anyway, I have many more steady state versus transitions, and so what happens effectively is I actually bias this downwards, and as was mentioned in the previous talk, there are ways of correcting for this, but I haven't, this is just to illustrate that point. So related to this is the idea of how we're designing our experiments. And a lot of the work that's been done to date, and I heard that there's a talk later on today, maybe, of event-related design, Janaya, or? Okay, maybe. I'm not sure. But a lot of the literature today has looked at block design data. And so in this case, we have our data matrix again. And what happens is we have a generally good correspondence between our class labels or this block design and what's going on within the voxels. And so what we can do is we can actually label these voxels in terms of the task category. But for the event-related design, what we'd ideally like is some time evolution incorporated into into these labels. So we'd perhaps like to label all of these simultaneously as one instance of this plus category, and all of these as another instance of the plus category. And so what can be done, what was mentioned in Mitchell 2004, and we've gone to use this as well, is you can actually create what I call a hyperimage. So you can actually make an image where the features are actually space and time. And you know, I think that that's maybe talked about today too, I'm not sure. And so for event-related designs, what you can actually have is some overlapping between these class categories. And to the same extent for time-locked averaging works, this is a reasonable thing to do. However, I think we can do better. So what's been done traditionally in the literature is to use either time-locked averaging or matrix form of a signal model to estimate the average hemodynamic response. But by using a mixed model form, you can actually obtain variations around that mixed model for each individual response. And I don't have time to get into the details of that right now, but what you can see for simulations is that you can actually get much cleaner estimates of the hemodynamic response function. Okay, so just briefly, real time. I'm going to go through this quite quickly because we're running late. But this is actually a map derived from the weight vector of my brain doing a left and right button press task. And you know, usually this is overlaid on nice anatomy, but I wanted to kind of look at the raw data. And so if we look at one voxel, we might not see much, actually, between left and right button presses in terms of overall intensity value changes. But if we look at the time course and if we rescale these gray values, we can actually play back this voxel so that it gets brighter and darker as I'm switching between left and right motor press tasks. And so this has been somewhat of the basis for doing real-time studies to date, is that if you know where to look and you can track that region of interest, you can actually, in this case of high signal to noise, get a pretty good tracking of what's going on in a reasonable amount of time. So I think that this approach really has a high degree of potential, being able to track regions of interest. However, often we're dealing with much noisier data than what I just showed. And if we want to show something that requires generating a map or looking at significance in the temporal domain, we actually have to wait for a time window to evolve before we can get that statistical information. And then, you know, in terms of some of these areas, how do we interpret what these areas are doing in terms of anatomy back to behavior? And so that can be somewhat problematic. So we also need to know exactly what's going on in terms of what the region is doing. So what does it mean to, for example, change anterior cingulate cortex? Well, it probably means different things in different contexts. So if we actually use this supervised learning approach, we can frame things in terms of tasks or stimuli that become intuitive. And for very complicated sorts of networks, we can actually pick up the patterns directly from the data. So what we've done is we've actually changed the image reconstruction process of our MRI scanner such that it does its normal job of reconstructing these images, but it's also communicating with the computer that is displaying the stimulus paradigm. And so what we're able to do then is do supervised learning on a training data set and then run the scanner not in training mode anymore, or continue to run it in training mode, but then start to run it in feedback mode where we can actually use these decoded images and adaptively control the stimulus that's being presented to the volunteer. And so here's an example of this. I crashed my PowerPoint this morning, so I'm not going to take any risks. We'll just play it outside of PowerPoint. But what's going on here, this is a very simple demonstration of this, where someone is tapping with their left index finger or their right index finger this is sped up by 12 times, so each of these blocks is actually taking about 30 seconds. So the left and right is actually kind of iconified by this block diagram in blue, and the classifier output is shown in pink. And so in this simple case, we're just thresholding this output and making the decision to either flip the arrow or update its position. And this was my early kind of crude attempt to look at what the brain was doing at the time these images were collected. So 8 minutes before this occurred, the person was doing the exact same task, only the cursor was stationary. And I'm not in PowerPoint anymore. Okay. So this is very, very robust, even with our what was then a bare bones implementation across subjects. And very importantly, I think, we were doing this with whole brain data and without changing anything procedurally from the control room of the scanner or even changing the stimulus presentation program, we just assigned different tasks to those different target conditions. So this was actually a psychiatrist who went in the scanner and didn't tell me what he was going to do, but what he did after the fact, he told me, was he thought sad thoughts about his father, who at the time was in poor health, and happy thoughts about his children, who at the time gave him happy thoughts. This is one example of several that we've collected on bilingual Mandarin and Korean speakers. In this particular example, the subject was internally narrating a recent travel experience back to China in alternating between Mandarin and English, so going in chronological order. One person had given a scientific talk in both places in Mandarin and English, so he went through his talk. And this is an example of someone that did both an affected motor or motoric action, but also an imagined motor task. And when we ran the scanner in testing mode, he was just doing the imagined motor task. And so we can actually use learning curves as a tool for looking at how much data are required. We did an 8-minute experiment, but we see that we get kind of asymptotically good results as we, with about 4 minutes worth of data or about 4 repetitions in this particular case. So classification in real time, I think, has a lot of potential. What we're doing is done on a TR by TR basis, and we have the ability, but we usually don't use it, to look at localized areas of the brain. We can do adaptive feedback, which I think really goes beyond linear systems output and input-output relationships. Traditionally, you have a fixed stimulus that's going to the system, which is the human, and we get some output, which are our activation patterns, our bold responses. This is a way to do adaptive experiments and tracking time courses and doing classification-based methods, I think, are going to be able to provide insights unattainable through traditional stimulus response experiments. And, in terms of work that we're starting up, I'm very interested in using this. I think it has the potential for evolving into a new class of fMRI experiments that are based on stimuli that adapt to internal states. We're looking at applications for rehabilitation and therapy using cognitive therapy and also other rehabilitation sorts of strategies for areas of addiction, depression, TBI, and speech and language at this point. And in the future, we'd like to look at different types of psychological stimuli that are most salient for things such as learning, memory, and emotional awareness. So this brings up a whole host of other statistical problems. If we'd like to look at memory or learning or rehabilitation, we can think of this system then as being non-stationary temporally. And so we're also looking at methods to be able to detect this non-stationarity and look for optimal learning updates to be able to correct for those non-stationarity effects. So a lot of this talk has been incoherent, but some of this talk has been based on a lot of work that I've done, but there are many others contributing to this. And I think some very useful reading include some review articles and some basic articles on this topic, textbooks, and there's also software, and I'd love to learn about other software, but MVPA is a very nice and easy to use package. We have, through AFNI, a plugin called 3DSVM, and also Stephen Strother has the MPairs package that I encourage you to look at. So just very quickly through our plugin, the interface is the sleek design of AFNI, which we all love, but essentially it's broken into two parts. You can select training data and masks, which allow you to do quite flexible things, such as Nikko Spotlight, if you want. You can look at training parameters. This is right now artificial, but we're only letting people use the linear kernels, but that can be switched off if enough complaints come by. And we can save the model output and look at both the weight vector and, in the future, other sorts of summaries on the brain, and also those alphas to look at where the support vectors are. And so it has an analogous command line that can be more complicated, but this is sort of the basic sort of command line invocations of it. And here's just kind of a simple example. So we had someone do a left versus right visual display, and using AFNI's sleek data viewing capabilities, we can look at this ideal time course, and we can then plot the alphas, in other words, which are the support vectors. So zooming in, we can actually see, for example, that these transition scans, since we didn't exclude them, come into play heavily in this model. And then also we can look at the model spatially on top of the anatomy. And then because we're within AFNI, we can pull out individual time series within that data. So we see in this case, the right voxel is out of phase with our labels, and the left data from the left hemisphere is within phase in our case. And so features of this, it's already distributed. If you're using AFNI, you have it. And if you don't, AFNI is free, and it supports all formats that AFNI supports. So that includes Nifty. So you can do your pre-processing in SPM, and then just import it into 3DSVM. And you know, you can do masking, censoring, and all of the other things that AFNI can do, but also visualize your alpha as a time series and your linear vectors as functional maps. And we've also included one method and hope to extend it in the future for doing multi-class classification. I'd like to thank my group and my funding, and thank all of you.
Thanks a lot, Steve. We're running a bit late, but we should still take a few questions.
The last output from AFNI, when you show the weights, how do you try to show
these weights? Well, this was done as an example. So, you know, I think that this might have come up in the previous talk. There are a number of ways and no standard. And so for this, it was fairly robust. This was a pretty robust task, and I didn't have to play around much after a certain point. Everything but visual cortex dropped away, and I could go much higher and visual cortex remained. But in general, that's a much larger problem. So you can look at a histogram, for example, of the weights. You can do the parametric sort of relabeling that you were talking about. All of that's capable, and I think that that's why the MVPA toolbox, or going through AFNI, where you have very flexible space-time manipulation sorts of tools already written, are quite useful. So there's no standard, and I'm not going to advocate any one way to threshold, but I think you should know what you're doing and try to make sure that that makes sense and justify what you're doing. In this case, it wasn't a very difficult thing because I can show you, I mean, the threshold doesn't change it.
If I understand understand correctly, the ones with the biggest weights are sort of the hardest ones to classify.
That's right.
That's exactly the opposite of what you want to be looking at in some sense. Right?
In some cases, that's exactly right. And so one thing that's reasonable, so the question was, I should say, is these support vectors, which are the ones near the discriminant boundary, are actually the most similar to each other. And so, first of all, more difficult to classify, and second of all, in some cases, less what you're interested in. And so that's another rationale that we use for dropping those transition scans, because we weren't really interested in what was going in those transition states. However, if you want to do things in real time, you might want to incorporate them either through, as I showed, it's possible to classify transition versus no transition, and maybe you'd have a cascade of classifiers, for example, in that case, that could help you make that decision. And you know, I guess the last point along that line is the fact that we're seeing it at transitions makes a lot of sense intuitively, because what you have is, in some cases, a mix of behavior if you have some sort of finite response time, but you also have this decay of the bold response. And so two conditions that happen close in time to each other are going to look very similar to each other because the bold response hasn't died out.
I have a question as well. In conventional analysis, people use T-maps, for example, when they contrast condition A and B. And some of the designs you've shown are kind of seem robust. So if you looked at the T-map, maybe it would look similar, right? So a very naive approach that's also, I think, didactically kind of helpful is to just use those T values as weights, right? So when it's positive, A is greater than B. When it's negative, B is greater than A. Do you have thoughts on would that be, in terms of accuracy, much worse or comparable?
First, I don't think that there's a right answer to that. I think in some cases, the T-map would look very similar to these weight vectors. And, you know, the T-map is derived on a mass univariate sort of approach where you're doing a T-test one voxel at a time. So to the extent that support vector machine or some other multivariate approach uses the distributed observation at a time, may make an impact. So I think that that's a way to learn about the data, and I actually think that it's important to look at the mass univariate GLM sort of approach along with these multivariate approaches. And you know, when the weights look similar, then you have some sanity check. But when they're different, it may not be because one is wrong and the other is right, but it may have something very important to tell us about the distributed nature of what you're trying to model.
One more.
I was interested, this definitely wouldn't apply to the real time, but you know, you have thought a lot about these transition scans and what they mean, but what about just averaging across your blocks, and then you reduce the amount of the data that you have, but at the same time, you improve your SNR.
So the question was, what about averaging across the blocks, which improves SNR and perhaps removes this problem of the transition scans? And I think that that's one approach. Some people, you know, again, I think ultimately some of this boils down to the questions that you're trying to ask and to making sure that you understand what that manipulation does in terms of affecting that. And so some groups have done that, and you know, I haven't been extremely general. You become very verbose as you make caveats about, you know, every single slide that you put up. But that data matrix is quite general, and so the time observations could be collapsed into an average if you'd like them to. So the idea is to kind of understand what you're doing and why you're doing it.
I think we should take a 5-minute break.